Hey there, everybody. As promised, we have an exclusive with the prolific, the fantastic, the amazing Dr. Kirsty Elliott-Sale, Associate Professor at Nottingham Trent University, PhD in female physiology, and that's just a basic introduction to her. So we are so excited that she's here and agreed to do this exclusive session just for the Academy. So this is the first expert we've got in, and she's going to set a very high bar. So you may have noticed that she very kindly did a piece for the blog. So that's open access, and that's available on the blog. I'll put a link in the resources for you to access that, so you can learn a little bit more about her background, and so she doesn't have to repeat herself as well. And there's some extra information in there. Kijija, Claire, and somebody else. I pinched a couple of your questions because they were so good. I asked those in the blog session because they're really pertinent to a wide audience. But I know you've got extra questions as well, so hopefully you're not hopefully you're smiling about that rather than frowning. So Kirsty, thank you so much for coming to speak to us today.
Honestly, it's a real pleasure. You know, I'm excited to hear these questions, and I hope I give good answers. If I'm the first, you know, I feel under pressure to say something clever. So hopefully.
So get away with you. Right. Okay. So what I've done is I've collated all your questions that you sent in, and I've put them into broad categories. So we'll just kind of go through those. Some of them might be quite quick fire because we have got a lot, and Kirsty is an exceptionally busy lady. So let's just kick off then with contraceptive use. So Kirsty Elliott-Sale, you might have read her systematic reviews and meta-analyses. I did signpost some of that, and also her BDSM podcast. So she's got published extensively on this, as well as other things. So first question from Kijija, are there any health risks or side effects to manipulating stopping menstruation with oral contraceptives?
Oh, good question. Good question. Right. I would say straight off the bat, they're not going to be dangerous, or we wouldn't be giving them out. So we can sort of relax in that extent. I would say then, in terms of, you know, long-term use, I mean, there's very little data on this because longitudinal studies tracking people over time is really difficult. And of course, even if you get people to stick with your study and be tracked over time, other things are changing at the same time as you sort of go through time. So you can't always say that it's that one particular thing that caused the effect. So I would say, in terms of, you know, research evidence and a research evidence base, you know, I'm not seeing a lot of papers to say, you know, yay or nay, yay they're safe, or no, they're not. I guess if I could give you one example, a sort of more of a theoretical example of why we might be a little bit cautious about, you know, long-term consistent contraceptive use. And that's probably coming from bone health would be my example. So if you think about the hormone concentration of an oral contraceptive user, their sort of natural, endogenous, their internal estrogen is low. It's, you know, all the time low, consistently downregulated is how I would describe it. I mean, if you think that, you know, estrogen is important for bone health, mediates and moderates bone health, then, you know, theoretically, if you're somebody who's had low levels of estrogen for 10 years or 20 years even, you know, what might be the implication of that on bone health? Having said that, you know, I doubt that you're taking a contraceptive and never moving. So if you've got a lot of load-bearing sort of, you know, impactful activity, it might balance it out. So in order to summarize my answer, I would say that, you know, we don't need to be too concerned that they're desperately unsafe because, of course, you know, they wouldn't be available. I would say that there's not a lot of research evidence to say, you know, pros or cons or yes or no for their long-term use. But we might be cautious about, you know, just using them blindly year after year, you know, particularly with something like bone health. But of course, we can compensate our bone health in other ways. I guess a take-home message, if you're a practitioner, is ask your female athlete why they're using an oral contraceptive, because often people start taking it and then when they don't even need it anymore, but they're still taking it. And it's like they almost forget. It's part of their routine. So if you can come off it, do come off it. Because when you think about it, our bodies are preset to have a menstrual cycle with peaks and troughs. It's not preset to be a flat line. So I would, again, theorize that if you don't need it, don't take it, and allow your body to come back to almost, I'm going to say, homeostasis, to how it should be. So maybe that's a talking point to the practitioner. Find out why, and if you don't need it, don't take it.
Yeah, great answer. Good advice there. I think that also relates to, and probably answers Tony's question, which is, those that remain on the contraceptive pill, do they still have a cycle that replicates the menstrual cycle? So I think you might have got your answer there, Tony.
it's not the same as I've just described. And I guess one thing, if you'll allow me, Claire, to quickly say,
yeah,
where it becomes confusing, and I can see where that question comes from, is because if you take an oral contraceptive and take your 7 pill-free days, you have a withdrawal bleed.
Yeah.
And we call that a period. Everybody's calling that a period. I take the pill. I've had my period last week. It's not a period. The word period should only be used for menstrual cycle, okay? If you're a pill user, call that a withdrawal bleed. It's not the same. And I think that's where historically the confusion has, you know, been of, but they have a period, it must be a similar type thing. And I think as well, because the 21 plus 7 is 28, we think that menstrual cycles are 28 days. And, it, you know, we've almost been tricked over the last few years, you know, to think they're the same. They're absolutely not the same. And if we can move forward, I guess, in a more accurate way, let's call them withdrawal bleeds if you're an oral contraceptive user.
There we go. Point noted. Okay, moving on to athletes. Paula asks, how do you broach the subject of diet with the endurance athlete who's clearly not eating enough, but is so set in their ways and has an old school coach? I think this probably resonates with a lot of people. However, their performance is affected, so that's also of concern. Any ideas or tips? Quick wins?
You know, I think you have to be clever here, and I think that the buy-in is performance. So if you mentioned that performance is affected, that's the buy-in, I think.
Yeah.
Of course, athletes want to be successful. They want to achieve the best that they can. Once you've established, I think, a buy-in, it's a long game for me. It's about building a relationship. I would never go straight in there with the diet. I would never start the conversation or the relationship like that. I would build a rapport. You know, I would only ever mention sort of, you know, nutrition and diet alongside everything else. I'd almost hide it within other conversations. And then as that relationship builds and you've got trust, then I think you can really sort of pull on that thread. And in terms of sort of hiding it about, you know, in between other information, I think you could offer something like, I'm going to call it a more general MOT with that athlete. And, you know, you sort of start to measure and test lots of things. And of course, then you want a feedback on that.
Yeah.
So then you're sitting down and suddenly you've got a legitimate reason. They've given you permission to talk about this because you measured some things. So that's probably how I'd go about it. But it's tricky, you know, and you don't want to ruin relationships, you know, and you don't certainly want to set anybody back. So that's sort of how I'd go about it, you know, using the buy-in, taking a slow approach and probably hiding it in amongst other sort of, you know, data or measures that I'm taking. It's, you know, kid gloves, I think.
Yeah, definitely. Oh, great. Good ideas there. Also from Paula, asking whether or not there are any considerations around rehabilitation of the female athlete who's close to menstruation. Anything at all?
Ooh, I sort of almost wonder why you would ask that. I mean, in terms of, and again, I'm going to sort of split this in two ways. In terms of hormone concentrations on physiology, sort of on sort of functioning, I can't see any reason why that would be a direct consideration. I guess where it may be, this sort of part two is, you know, in the lead up to menstruation, if the athlete, you know, maybe has, some of your listeners will know it as PMS, some will know it as PMT, so pre-menstrual, I guess, symptoms for the want of a word then. If they sort of suffer from changes in mood or even sort of physical side effects, then, you know, that I think might have a bigger impact on how they want to be, how you work with them and what the rehab looks like. So again, you know, if they feel very tender or they're really fatigued or, you know, they're cramping or they have headaches, anything like that, that might impact upon the approach you take. But I guess as a more general, you know, do we have to think about rehabilitation, changing it in the run-up to menstruation? I would say probably not, outside of that sort of more perceptional type. Again, I may have completely misinterpreted that question, and it's a shame we can't ask in real time, but I'd love to know what prompted that question. So yeah.
Well, Paula, if you're listening, email me and we can clarify if that's not met, but I think that's the theme of the question is my interpretation as well. Claire, so strength training, should women be thinking, maybe this is a more lifestyle approach perhaps, should women be thinking about doing more strength training, that is, given that women lack strength? I'm presuming you mean there, Claire, in absolute levels perhaps, but have natural endurance. So maybe you mean fatigue, resistance again there, or maybe you don't, I don't know. So strength training, basically, do you think women should be doing more?
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. Because I think, you know, strength training is not just for strength, you know, outcomes. It underpins everything. And why wouldn't you? Yes, yeah. Absolutely. I'm going to keep
superb.
That.
Yeah. And you know my thoughts on that as well. So I think we're joined up in that approach. And a quick one from Claire again, thinking about maybe a cyclical approach here. Do women do better, I think this is in training, in two hard weeks, one relatively easy week, than men who seem to do three or four hard weeks, then relative rest? So I think maybe, are you asking there, Claire, perhaps if you tailor the intensity of training commensurate with the cycle of a woman?
Personally, I wouldn't tailor training to the menstrual cycle. So, you know, I wouldn't do that. And at present, you know, I don't really see the evidence to support that. I would say more generally, you know, women adapt and respond to resistance training in the same way as men, as do, you know, older athletes. So I would say that, you know, whatever regime or periodization that works successfully, you know, it's almost immaterial what sex you are, we respond similarly. So I guess that's the approach I would take. You know, I always say train for the demands of the sport. You know, I think that's a global, decent concept you can't go wrong with, in the absence of, you know, overwhelming high quality evidence that suddenly tells us, no, you need to tailor this to the menstrual cycle. We don't have that right now. So I would go for train for the demands of the sport and, you know, not worry too much about, you know, changing weeks and line of menstrual cycles.
Yeah. I think maybe that ties into what you said in the blog that we did just now and the prior answer, that maybe we're thinking about on an individual level. So if she's really suffering the stomach cramps, like you were saying, or she's feeling particularly fatigued, might not be wise to absolutely hammer her on that day. And would you say be forgiving of themselves and of them?
You know, it always sort of surprises me, because a lot of sort of, you know, male coaches, and I'm not picking on male coaches, but a lot of them sort of say to me, you know, should I give them the day off, you know, if they don't feel well because of, you know, their period or PMS? And I'm like, well, yeah, if they came in and said they had a migraine, you'd give them time off, right? And so, yeah. You know, you have to stigmatize it, that it's this weakness that women have. If you're not feeling well or you're really fit, be kind to ourselves, you know, be kind to each other. It just doesn't make sense to me. You know, if your athlete turned up and said, a male athlete, you know, I have, you know, stomach cramps, I had food poisoning, you wouldn't go, no, you must train, you know. I think we just need to be more sensible. So yeah, absolutely. If somebody warrants rest, of course, as a consequence of side effects, we must give that to them. But again, that's exactly what you said, Claire. It's that individual, you know, having some flexibility in your system. But equally, I don't think you need to start periodization just based purely on weeks of menstrual cycle. I think, you know, we can respond, but I think we would respond with kindness if anybody had any illness, regardless, or condition or discomfort, regardless of whether it's linked to the menstrual cycle or not.
Yeah, nicely put. Okay, so moving on to pregnancy. So Khadija and Valentina, I asked your initial question in the other session because it's so good. Not that these aren't good as well. Is it more effective to start strength training during pregnancy or after delivery to prevent bone density loss due to breastfeeding for female athletes?
Ooh.
Well, you've been tested, aren't you? I'm so
fully convinced that there's a whole big problem with bone mineral density that's linked to breastfeeding. And maybe that's where I'd stop. I mean, you know, I think, I'm stopping myself before I go on too far.
Take a breath.
I guess with breastfeeding, you know, it depends on the time scale, you know, and most women tend to do it for relatively short periods of time. So I guess what I'm trying to say is I'm not overly anxious that all women are dropping, you know, or negatively affecting their bone mineral density whilst they're breastfeeding. So that would be my first point. And then the second point would be, if you're able to, if you know, exercise training, resistance training, whatever that might be, is not contraindicated during pregnancy, why are you not doing it? So to me, the answer would be, you know, pregnancy plus postpartum, you know, unless it's contraindicated, and then just postpartum. But as I would say, that to caveat all of that, I'm not particularly, you know, worried about, you know, postpartum women losing or, you know, having this massive impact on BMD with breastfeeding. Again, unless you're not doing anything else. If you were an astronaut who was breastfeeding and you didn't have gravitational pull and no weight-bearing activity, then I might be worried about you.
You know what? I think we need to get Elon Musk on this as well. So you need to consult with
his. Our next study in space. Who's in for that? I think there are so many other things that whilst you're breastfeeding would probably anyway sort of, you know, maintain your BMD. So I'm not that worried. I would say both, unless contraindicated, and then for sure in the postpartum space as soon as it's safe to do so. But really good questions. You know, I can see that people are really thinking, you know, carefully about this.
There you go. You heard it from Professor Sale, Elliot Sale there. I don't know if you're able to comment on this one. Is exercise stroke pelvic floor general exercise effective in preventing incontinence associated with pregnancy? Maybe slightly outside a specific remit, but we can comment on.
In my wheelhouse, and I'm naughty to be so emphatic, but I'm really fortunate that at the minute we're doing some work with postpartum, actually military service women. As part of that, we have a really great physiotherapist who's working with us, and sort of Thea is now sort of specialising in you know, sort of women's physiotherapy, and she would kill me if I didn't say yes to that because she's all over this. And so I am again stealing somebody sort of else's thunder, but you know, I think having listened to Thea enough, I'll be really confident in saying to you guys, you know, yes, it really is the way forward. And I'm going to overshare now. I missed a trick. I Claire knows that I have twins, and they were big. So I was big, they were big. And I so have so many pelvic floor problems now because I didn't do it during, I didn't do it afterwards. And 10 years afterwards, Thea is telling me even now that she can still help me. So that if that doesn't convince you, we should be doing this, you know, 10 years, 13 years later. Jesus, they're 30. She's still telling me it's not too late and I should do something. So that's a big, very long answer, but that's a big yes from me.
Yeah, that's amazing. I think also we're seeing, particularly in the UK, like we were saying before, how females is becoming such a big and hot topic. And I know you've done the at your cervix. Did you do that podcast, or you've done some podcasts with female physios on this topic, and there's also Bill Taylor as well, who's in this group, who is prolific in pelvic health as well. So all of which I know of them would tell you yes as well. So I think that's a yes. So one from Tony again, just finishing off on pregnancy, post-pregnancy. Tony is actually a personal trainer, but upskilled to manage injury. Tremendous at what he does. We have the generic advice of what to do with clients, but realistically, what are the timeframes for clients to return to normal or train normally? In other words, you know, after pregnancy, when can you start to train them as you would another person who hadn't been pregnant?
Great question. I have a bee in my bonnet about this particular thing right now. So again, we're working on a paper, a sort of a type of an opinion piece around sort of pregnancy, postpartum in athletes, the military, and basically women with arduous occupations. And this is one of the things that we've highlighted as something that needs to be looked at moving forward. So I guess the first bit is, you know, we tend to always go, oh, wait till 6 weeks before you do anything. That number is somewhat arbitrary. We still put our finger on where it is. The only thing we can see is it sort of ties in with, in the UK, when you have that, you know, we call that 6 week check with the midwife or a, you know, healthcare professional. And, you know, outside of it's the time where you get an appointment and somebody looks at you or chats to you mostly. I can't remember that anybody sort of does anything physical. But that seems to be where this sort of almost myth comes in, wait till 6 weeks. Now, I guess what we're going to sort of put out in this paper is maybe rehabilitation from pregnancy starts on day one for some people, because, you know, some people will have had uncomplicated pregnancies, uncomplicated labors and births, and they're ready and they're good to go. And you know, why are we waiting? Of course, there'll be others who have had difficult ones or are stressful and traumatic births and they need to heal or C-sections, and that will need longer. But I think, you know, we're sort of going to push the envelope a little bit here and say that, you know, we don't think there's a number where you're good to go. I think we need, again, to take this on an individual basis. But I would say, I think you mentioned there in Tony's question that he said something about when the menstrual cycle might return to normal. I would say that don't wait for the return of the menstrual cycle as a sort of an indicator of when you can return to training. I don't think those two are linked. And secondly, the return of a menstrual cycle is so variable. I mean, some women will, you know, have their first period 3, 4, 5 weeks after giving birth. That was me, hoo-hoo. Other people won't have it for 8 or 9 months. It will take that long to come back. And of course, you know, some women it's affected by breastfeeding and so on. So I would say, you know, that's highly variable. So again, we can't put a time scale on that. But I would say, don't link those things. Don't wait for that. That's not an indicator to train more. And then I think in terms of when to train, look at that on an individual basis. And, you know, healthy, uncomplicated pregnancies and births, let's try a little something. You know, we're not talking about getting them out running marathons the day after, but it's slow, it's progressive, it builds up. And of course, for those who have got some side effects, incontinence, those sort of things, we are going to have to take a different approach. But, you know, I have a lot of trust. I trust physiotherapists. Mm. I now work with 2 physiotherapists. I'm delighted. And it's brought a whole new, you know, I guess, context and understanding for what I knew about physiology. To now work with these physiotherapists, I'm seeing, you know, a lot more. So I would say, Tony, if you have the chance, is to get your athlete to a physiotherapist, particularly somebody who sort of specializes in women's health physiotherapy. And that's probably the best bet. So sorry, quite a long answer.
No, really, really informative there. Thank you, Kirsty. And a good bit of advice at the end to implement. So, yeah, superb. Okay, moving on to kind of menopause or perimenopause. Lisa Appleby, I would really like to know more about the perimenopause stroke menopause in the older athlete. Does taking HRT plus testosterone help?
Oh, okay. Yes, I would like to know more too about this. Not a huge amount of research on this. It seemed to be more popular sort of in the 90s research on sort of menopause and HRT. What I would say is, you know, we discussed the menstrual cycle where estrogen and progesterone have these cyclical changes. We discussed oral contraceptives where they're down-regulated. I guess for the menopause, the first thing to understand is that, you know, it's a bit like oral contraceptive use, you know, over time. So during that sort of just, you know, menopause is hard to put your finger on. You normally know it after you've been through it. So, you know, around the time of the menopause, basically the cyclical pattern is sort of obliterated and there's a sharp decline in estrogen and progesterone, ending in a flat line in those two things forever. So I guess if you sort of conceptualize, well, do we think these hormones affect performance? So looking at that systematic review I did in the menstrual cycle, you know, if we link performance or, you know, training ability to these hormones, well, maybe something will change because these two hormones are bottoming out. And some of the research has shown, you know, things like muscle strength decline, you know, with the menopause. And interestingly, similarly, the papers have shown that if you add HRT back into the system, hormone replacement therapy back into the system, then strength will increase again. So it really seems like there's some sort of relationship with these hormones and strength. You know, I can't guarantee there is, but the evidence is you know, fairly compelling. So I think that the question is really good. I would say to, you know, again, it depends, isn't it? If you've got the ability to track somebody as they transition, great. If somebody arrives already postmenopausal, well, then it almost is immaterial what happened because you're dealing with the consequences. But it is, it's a really interesting question. So of course, we know that the menopause is associated with a decrease in sort of, you know, bone health, BMD, that sort of thing. So I would watch out for, changes in bone, changes in muscle, definitely change the mood. We keep coming back to this as well. We can't separate the two. And of course, going through the menopause, somebody once described it as, the Snow White and the 7 Dwarfs. And they sort of said that there were 7 symptoms associated with the menopause. One was osteoporosis, but there was hot flushes. There was, you know, the irritable one. There was the angry one, you know. And a lot of them were, you know, sort of more linked with our sort of moods and feelings. So sorry, I may have gone off on many tangents there, but I would say there seems to be something there that the menopause, you know, is showing some declines in function, and HRT has been shown to sort of, you know, make good on some of those deficits. You know, don't know a lot about the addition of testosterone, to be really honest. Could make sense, you know, if there's losses in muscle. So, and in fact, one last thing I'll finish with, you know, postmenopausal women, we're super obsessed, aren't we, with osteoporosis. It's like the go-to thing. And somebody once said to me, I've forgotten who, osteoporosis is only a problem if you fall over. What stops you from falling over? Mostly muscle strength. Come on. See, yeah. Back to muscle strength. So, you know, I'm not as obsessed with bone health in the postmenopausal space. I'm quite obsessed with maintaining muscle strength, you know, and you know, that core strength and all of that, because it's only a problem if you fall down. So if we can and keep you strong, that's what I would do.
Oh, Kirsty, that's music to my ears. When I was in Edinburgh, I was banging that drum so hard. I was dealing with fragility fractures in the proximal humerus or distal radius, and it's not the fact that they might get rehab here, but what made them fall over and what they're going to lose as their kind of deconditioning is looking down there. Oh, yeah, anyway, Henna wants to know about the perimenopausal period, the change in hormone ratios, and what's a good goal to be working towards with women in this age group. I think maybe you've touched on it quite a bit there.
Surviving it, I would say, is a good one. I think the perimenopause, I'm assuming this question sort of, you know, this person is asking, it's that sort of transition really. And as I think I sort of almost joked about it, you only really appreciate it when you're out the other end. It's, you know, more something to look back on and go, oh, that explains that, or, you know, very few women really have enough self-awareness to know that this is what's happening. So I would say, you know, a bit like the menstrual cycle, we keep telling people, track, you know, track performance, track your feelings. I mean, if you're super duper, you know, got loads of resources available to you and money and all this and the other experts, of course, track the hormone concentrations. But I would just say that, you know, I mentioned that post-menopause, the hormones are low. I guess that during the transitioning, they're all over the place. So I would basically say that, you know, try not to focus too much on, you know, being locked into this is what I should do, because your hormones are all over the place and you know, trying to predict when that might be. I'm just going to be really simple here and say, be kind to yourself and be kind to this client. Just that, you know, surviving it when your hormones are all over the place. I remember speaking to somebody transitioning through their menopause, and she said to me, I took a frying pan to my husband's head in sheer rage, almost like a psychotic rage, not in her control at all. We've also heard this from women who are undertaking IVF, and they've got these super physiological changes in estrogen and progesterone. So I guess the take-home message here is that these hormones are really linked to, you know, mood, anger, and an anxiety. You know, people who can't leave the house, they're so anxious because of these hormones. So I would say, in this point, don't be too worried about tracking or predicting, because it's so all over the place. Just be kind, watch out for things like mood and motivation and fatigue, and work maybe in response to that.
Right, so be supportive of your client, what she likes to do, how she feels afterwards, and that's some really great advice, really practical advice too. Okay, so moving on to, we've got four more questions left. Sorry, I know you're extremely busy, woman. Post-menopause, perhaps, we just touched on it there, osteoporosis. So I've spoken a lot about the LIFMOR trial, so you will have heard of that potentially. But from your perspective, Kirsty, is there a most effective exercise protocol, would you say, to address osteoporosis, maybe even reverse osteoporosis?
Reverse?
I'm not sure.
I absolutely think we need to intervene to, you know, certainly slow or stop any further decline. I'm going to super quick just say that, you know, I'm a big fan of resistance training here. So, you know, I'm sure everything that you've said before, we're going to go with that. You know, I don't think there's a, you know, an absolute sort of, you know, gold standard sort of program, but depending on who that woman is and what her experience is, it could be anything from walk, jog to, I would hope, more resistance training, and that could be functional resistance training, or hopefully, you know, bands, or even better in the gym, all sorts of stuff. We can go mad here, you know, we don't have to limit ourselves. And actually, my experience, limited as it is, I did my postdoc. I was really fortunate to work with some sort of, you know, older women in a strength training program. They were amazing, you know. I was sort of thinking, God, what can I get them to do at home with a few bands? They were in my, you know, we had a gym set up on campus. They were in the gym, lifting weights, loving life. You know, they were great. And you know what? They turned up on time. They never missed a training session. Oh, and they're great for muscle biopsies as well. Anyway, I digress. But I just think the world here is your oyster. But I do like the idea of lifting, in that postmenopausal population.
Yeah, and that links quite nicely into the masterclass that's just gone on resistance training with older adults. So very great seamless link there. I think we've covered this one. So from Tony, I have a client who's going through the menopause. What are the things I should expect when she trains, and what should I avoid? And then, if anything, I think Kirsty's covered that quite
She can well in- tell Tony better than me, because she'll be the one living it. And I think that probably raises a really good point here, maybe two good points. One is, you know, I think we need to change the culture and just talk about all these things, whether it's periods or ovulation or the menopause or bad mood swings, whatever. Let's just talk about it. You know, I'm fed up of stigmas or people thinking that, you know, these are taboo topics. I hate that phrase. If I see that in the media one more time, periods are taboo. They're not. Nothing is a taboo. Let's talk about everything. That's the first thing. And the second thing, and I've sort of maybe said it before, I said I was really impressed by the quality of the questions here, but I'm super impressed that if you're all thinking about this already, and I think you're winning already. Even, you know, you may have limited knowledge of female physiology, but if you're thinking about it, in my book, you're already doing something about it. The fact that you've acknowledged there could be a change or a difference, you know, between sexes, or a change at the menopause, you know, you're winning at life here already by thinking about these questions, by questioning these things. But I would say, you know, if you're talking to your client, she'll let you know what's going on with her better than I can. React to her rather than reacting to sort of, you know, a piece of paper, which was a study on 8 different women 25 years ago.
Yeah. Go with it. Oh, amazing. And did you get that as well? She's super impressed with these questions. So that's amazing. I think as you were talking there, I remembered something vaguely. I'm not going to be very specific now, but was it in the last Olympics, was it a Chinese swimmer that spoke on TV about having her period and having really bad stomach cramps in relation to her performance? Like, I was like, that's fantastic. And how, you know, it's stupid to say she was brave to do that, but, you know, I guess that took an element of bravery.
It sure did, because everybody went, you know, and all the women were going, well, yeah, of course, we're dealing with this all the time. And the media, and those maybe reading the media who are not sports women, they were all like, oh, I can't believe she said that. That's super brave. And it's just like, and it really showed, this is silly. You know, why are we talking about it? Literally, I'm going to just, poor description, but under the covers we're talking about it. Can we just come out and say, you know, this is how I feel today. I have my period, or whatever it might be. I mean, I always think about, tennis players, I can't remember which tennis player it was. She came out and said something about her performance. But I worry, but I think about tennis players in white clothes having the period. It's like, I really feel for them. And also, like, people like rowers who go out on the water for hours on end. And I'm thinking, you know, do they literally have to put their hand up and say, can I go in? Because I need to, you know, I need to change my sanitary wear or whatever. And so the sooner we can normalize this, the better. So if you guys are thinking about it, if you guys are talking about it, you're already winning in my book. So good for you.
Awesome. I completely relate to that. I used to play octopus underwater hockey, and would be, some of them would be a day of tournament playing underwater, and you know, you just can't control what's going to happen to you. So forget the stomach cramps and the stuff that was painful, that just planning and thinking, and you know, and oh yeah, it just adds an element of stuff that you don't need in competition, doesn't it?
And I mean, I started a presentation, I think it was just towards the end of 2019, so super recently, giving a presentation, and you know, it'd been a whole sort of series of presentations all about female athletes, and I stood up and I went, oh, you know, this is the title of my talk, I'm on day 2 of my cycle, so I have my period today, And it was like, ooh. And I'm like, oh, I'm sorry. If you're surprised and shocked by that, you're in the wrong session. Because, you know, this is not something I'm not embarrassed to tell. You know, and one guy, you know, afterwards sent me an email. He said, you should start every talk with telling people what day they're on. Because he said, he was watching the reaction. And yet those who were like, oh, isn't she oversharing? Oh, gosh, how, you know. Oh. And it's just like, you're in the wrong session. You're not going to be successful as, you know, a trainer or a physio or a practitioner or a nutritionist. You can't be, because you can't even, you know, what's right in front of your face. If you can't take that.
Love it. Love it. Okay. So last question, which relates to injuries. So in your experience and your knowledge and practice, do you see that there's any gender, or should we say sex, gap in sports injuries? If yes, no pressure, what's the main cause? What are the most common injuries among female athletes? So any of those, and that's from Valentina.
So I would say that there's definitely a gap. And I think that's sort of historical. You know, we mentioned about this legacy before. And I think, you know, the reason is because, you know, researchers, it can be difficult for researchers to control for menstrual cycle phase when doing these lab-based studies. And there's just a real reluctance to incorporate yet another thing into your research design. It's another variable to standardize or control and so on. But I think that's why there is a bit of a sort of a sex gap in the literature. In terms of, you know, maybe why women might, you know, sustain different injuries or have different, you know, prevalence of a particular injury, you know, certainly, you know, there are some links, I think, with these hormones. I would say, you know, so if we take ACL, so ACL is the go-to injury, right, when we talk about sort of females. We know that more females sustain ACL injuries than males, I think 6 times as many. There's anecdotal evidence from you know, some athletes are telling us, are really linking it with a moment in their menstrual cycle. There's some research evidence. The research evidence suggests that, you know, during ovulation, when estrogen is at its highest, you know, that's when ACL injuries are more likely, or the risk is higher. But I think I was shared with you, you know, sort of before when we were chatting, that, you know, that paper went out, a paper went out about estrogen being high, ACL injury, the risk increasing, went out on Twitter a couple of years ago now. And athletes came to Twitter going, no, my ACL went when I had my period. And so then there was almost a group of anecdotal evidence saying it occurs when you're menstruating, when estrogen is at its lowest, versus the research evidence was saying when estrogen is at its highest and laxity, you know, is it affected, that's when the highest risk is. So, you know, what I would say is there appears to be sex differences for sure. What's driving those, we don't completely know. We imagine it is linked to these ovarian hormones. I have a PhD student who's working on this exact question. So, you know, it's something that we're looking into. But I would say, you know, very much an emerging landscape, you know, and one to watch. But of course, when you think about injuries as well, it's a whole thing, you know, it's a whole host of things that happen, right? And so even if we sort of had enough data to say, look, we've seen a lot of ACL injuries at this moment of the menstrual cycle, if I send that paper for review, somebody could write back and say, were they all on the same surface though? You know, so maybe it's a surface issue or a footwear issue or whatever. So to drill down that direct relationship, I think it's going to be tricky. So, you know, watch this space for sure, but I'm not sure we'll ever, you know, really say with complete certainty that this caused this, you know, exclusively. I think it's almost a perfect storm, isn't it? An injury, or the opposite. It's just pure unluck. You know, you're not lucky on that day, and something happens that was unexpected and couldn't have been predicted.
Totally. And like you were saying before, you know, the varied landscape, it might be that we're talking about, it's not physiologically driven, maybe it's psychologically driven, and you just feel like a pile of shit on that day, and you're going into a challenge without being appropriately aware, and that's the driver, which may be linked to this, oh, who even knows, it's a minefield, isn't it?
You can imagine, though, the size of the questionnaire to collect all that information. So the day after your injury, when in your menstrual cycle was it, what were you thinking about? Were you happy? Were you sad? What was the footwear? What was the ground? What was the wind? You know, were you concentrating? You know, it's like, oh my God, we can take all of it. It's a jigsaw, right? Yeah. And on any given day, if you remove one of the pieces, is that the thing that causes the whole thing to collapse? We just don't know. I think it's the same as, you know, injury, I think, of like performance. It's so multifaceted. To predict injury, to predict performance, we think is almost impossible. I think all we can do is the best we can for the majority of days. That's all we can do, and appreciate that sometimes it's just out of our hands.
Superb. Well, I think that's a really nice place to end this. I'm so appreciative of your time, and I know everybody in the Academy is as well. And you heard it, some fantastic questions. I was genuinely keen to hear the answers of those as well. So Kirsty, I just want to say a massive thank you for taking so much time to speak to us and giving us such valuable information.
Honestly, it's my pleasure. I love great questions. You know, sometimes for me, with the greatest of respect to other audiences, I ask the same thing over and over again. And these were really quite new questions. So yeah. I'm delighted to be sort of stretching myself and my thoughts and experiences, you know, to try and help a little bit with these questions.
Oh, great. Well, thank you. And again, I hope you've got a lot from this session. I certainly have. And if you want to reach out to Kirsty, we'll put her Twitter handle. You said that was the best. Just want to say it there and I'll put it in the notes as well.
Find me just on Twitter at Elliottsale. Claire will spell it for you. But yeah, that's the best place. Or as I say, if you've got an absolute burning question, drop me an email, you know, Google NTU, you'll find me. Don't worry.
That's super generous of you. Thanks so much, Kirsty. And have a lovely rest of day. And I look forward to hopefully catching up with you for a coffee in the not too distant future.
Absolutely, for sure. Coffee's on me, cake's on you, and we'll put the world to rights.
Cool. Thanks so much. Take care.
Yeah.